This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nelly. Our topic this week is soybean demand, and our guest is Jim Sutter, CEO of the U.S. Soybean Export Council. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the Soy Checkoff. USEC's Jim Sutter is next. Wanted to take a moment and talk to soybean farmers. Nearly 500,000 of you are in the U.S. growing over 4 billion bushels of soybeans a year. And the Soy Checkoff is working hard to grow demand, innovating, testing, and showcasing new uses in new industries such as firefighting foam, tires, straws, shoes, or 1,000 other products. To learn more, visit unitedsoybean.org and keep on growing. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. The U.S. soybean industry faces tremendous challenges in maintaining and growing markets for our products. The domestic crop holds superior quality to the rest of the global supply, but sees political obstacles in trade and economic headwinds from a strong dollar. Jim Sutter, CEO of the U.S. Soy Export Council, says the industry has seen periods of large global supplies before and is having success in diversifying the global customer base.
Rough numbers. U.S. soy exports, and when I talk U.S. soy, beans, meal, oil, U.S. soy exports up 19% year-to-date. Exports to China up 3%. Exports to other destinations up 40%. So that would tell me that the diversification efforts are working. Now, sure, there's some of that that maybe is politically driven a little bit, but the diversification efforts are working. Last year, our total soy exports, about 40% of it went to China. If we went back 5, 6, 7 years, that number would be in the high 50s. So we have had success in diversifying. We're, you know, our teams are doing a lot of work in markets around the world to help those markets grow, to learn more about U.S. soy, to learn how to use it. So yes, it's working. But also I remind people that China is such a huge part of the global soy demand. Roughly 60% of all soy that leaves one country and goes to another. So the international trade in soy, almost 60% of that ends up in China. So to totally say, you know, we're just not going to supply China at all. If you're in the soybean business and you want to be exporting soy, I don't think you can say that. And why would we want to do that? We've been a supplier to China. The U.S. has had a relationship with China. U.S. soy farmers have been investing their dollars in China together with FAS since 1982. So 42 years. So we don't want to give up that relationship. We've got a lot of long-term, very loyal customers in China that we want to continue to do business with. We just don't want that to be too big a stake.
I'm told by members in the industry that the Chinese really don't want to store the Brazilian product, that if they're going to take a product and put it into storage for future use, they would rather that be a U.S. supply. Is that still the case?
Yes, that is still the case. And particularly this year, we hear from the Chinese, and we've seen purchases being made that would say maybe they're even accelerating their kind of rotation program of their storage to take advantage of the really super quality that the harvest from 24 turned out to be. And also, you know, maybe drier than some farmers wanted it to be as it came off the field. Mm-hmm. But if you're in the business of having soybeans in long-term storage, those dry soybeans really store well. So that is definitely still the case.
There's a lot of distance between Xi Jinping and the people who actually use the product that is imported. So is there a different message that's coming from the politics of China and from the end user in China?
Oh, I think definitely. I think, and it's sort of like the different message I think we hear in the United States. At a very high level, the geopolitical message is that there are real challenges between the countries. There are real serious problems that have to be worked out. And no doubt, there are serious differences of opinion that need to be resolved or at least understood. But at the business level, both in the United States, from the exporters, from farmers, in China, from the importers, the users of the soy, the people that are taking soybeans and turning them into meal and oil, and especially the people that are using them to grow livestock or fish, they want to continue this relationship with U.S. They've had a long-term good relationship. They don't want to only have one supplier. They tell us about the quality problems with the Brazilian soybeans that they have, and they like U.S. beans. Now, we're not going to be their 100% supplier, but they want to continue to have this relationship. But it's this geopolitical thing at the high level that is, you know, kind of putting all that a little bit at risk.
Let's pull the focus together, if we can, on the big demand and on the big producer.
Mm-hmm.
We've obviously seen change. How has China's demand for oil seeds changed over the past 5, 10, 15, 20 years? And how has Brazilian production changed? Because the U.S. is no longer the major supplier in the globe, but the Chinese continue to grow in terms of their demand.
Right. So first off, if you look at China, they have just continued to grow. And, you know, there was a leveling off and a little bit of a decline during the COVID time. But since then, it's climbed up again. And, you know, you hear people saying that, well, China's finished and their demand's going to continue to kind of go down. And, you know, they won't be this huge demand player anymore. I think that misses the point. I think China will continue to, maybe they won't grow at the same rates that they grew before, but they're going to continue to grow in terms of being an import buyer. So China's going to continue to be there. Brazil, yes, they continue to put more land into production. They continue to grow to meet largely China's demand. A lot of Brazilian soybeans, I think roughly 80% of their exports end up going to China. So that's a lot of their soybeans that go there. And, you know, I think that from what I see, Brazil has plans to continue to grow their production footprint, maybe at a little slower rate than they have been, but I think they want to continue to grow. So here in the U.S., being a smaller supplier, the number two in terms of the size of production, the number two in terms of the exporter, I think it gives us the opportunity to really maybe pick and choose the markets that we're trying to serve a little bit more. And I know our exporters are, yes, they continue to serve China, but they're also looking at a lot of other markets, which is exactly what we want to see happening. Back to this diversification.
To a parallel, sustainability and quality of product. How do either of these play into the equation of global demand, and does either or both of these provide us a leg up?
That's a great question, and that's actually a key part of our strategy. Our strategic goals, we've got three main ones, and two of them deal with the things you just talked about: differentiating U.S. soy from other origins, and then elevating a preference for U.S. soy. And a couple of the key things that we talk about are the quality of our U.S. soybeans, the lack of damage in the U.S. beans, the low moisture in the beans this year, the nutritional bundle in the U.S. soybeans relative to other origins. That is all something that people who actually feed the product that comes out of those beans, if they're either feeding the meal or refining the oil, they notice that quality, and it has a financial impact for them. The other thing you mentioned, the sustainability. Wow. You know, when we first started talking about sustainability, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years ago maybe, it was sort of something that we thought we had to play defense against. Hey, people are going to try and tell us what to do. We need to kind of hold this back. That has shifted. That paradigm shifted because we've figured out that the U.S. has a sustainability advantage versus other origins. The great job that U.S. soy farmers do, other crop farmers as well, but the great job done in the United States, the support received from the U.S. Soil Conservation Service in the old days, you know, USDA, to make sure that we're farming in a sustainable way, we are well ahead of the rest of the world in those practices, whether it's Brazil, Argentina, even Europe, where they talk a lot about sustainability. We've got them beat from a sustainability perspective on the farm. So we are using sustainability as a marketing advantage and something we're talking about. So quality, sustainability, two key ways that we're trying to differentiate U.S. soy?
I would have to believe that to some customers, sustainability is a high priority. Europe.
Oh, absolutely.
But I would also have to believe there are other customers, China, that it probably doesn't matter so much.
You've identified that very well, Jeff. But what we are seeing is, and I don't know how it will impact the actual purchases, but we continue to see with more people on social media, with the Gen Z people having more of an influence on buying patterns, the importance of sustainability is growing rather than going down. I think more people are caring about it, even in markets where you may say, I'm surprised they care about sustainability.
We're talking about a Brazilian crop this year. If the weather holds, some analysts have that over 170 million metric tons, a tremendous supply, and I continue to hear stories that their farmers want to add acreage. The question is, where does that acreage come, and how much it is tied to rainforests that might impact overall the demand for the product that they're raising?
Yeah, that's a good point. It seems that the land that Brazil is now bringing more into production is coming more from the Cerrado, from the prairies, if you will, rather than the Amazon, rather than taking and deforesting, if you will. And they've become quite clever, I would say, in the way that they are marketing their conversion of the Cerrado, because they talk about degraded pasture. And they say that the only way to, you know, make good use of this degraded pasture land is to turn it into farmland. So it seems to me it's a bit of a shell game, because if you have Cerrado land and then you pasture it and you overpasture it, then it becomes degraded pasture, and then the only way to save that land is to put it into cropland.
You have a president-elect that is using the tariff word very strongly, both to Canada and to Mexico at 25%, and raising questions about the USMCA, and threatened increased tariffs as well to China.
Right.
How have tariffs impacted us before, and besides China, where else might that come to bear?
Yeah, that's certainly something that everybody in the soy world is thinking about. They see this talk about tariffs, and I think it's quite concerning to us. Historically, soy enjoys pretty good access in many markets around the world. We don't have big tariffs that we have to deal with. During the trade spat, to use your word, with China back 5 years ago or so, we did have tariffs that were a significant issue, and the impact they had was just sort of essentially shutting trade off almost with China and forcing soybeans from the U.S. to go to other markets, and kind of the reverse with Brazil. So the result of that was that our U.S. soy farmers got a lower price for their soybeans. Chinese consumers paid a higher price, and the Brazilian farmers also received a higher price. So not a situation that we want to get back into, but certainly something that is a risk. I don't see that tariffs in other places around the world, you know, who knows, never say never, but I just can't imagine that we'll actually see the USMCA situation kind of blown up. I've got to think that's a negotiating position. The rest of the world, I'm not so sure on. On China, I've been trying to talk about the idea, and I know I'm just one lone voice here, but I've been trying to talk about the idea that we went through a trade spat. It was painful for both the United States and for China. Back in 2020, in January of 2020, the Phase One agreement was signed with great accolades from President Trump at the time, President Xi Jinping. Many people thought our negotiators, the Chinese negotiators, had really done a good job putting together an agreement that could make a difference in the trading relationship between those two countries. And it was just getting started to be implemented, and then COVID hit. And COVID, I think, took everybody's focus as we tried to figure out what it means and how we'd all deal with this global pandemic.
It took the headlines.
It took the headlines. It absolutely did. And then shortly after that, we had a change in administration. And when you have a change in administration, you know, the things the previous administration did sort of lose focus. So anyway, the Phase One agreement never really had a chance to be put into play. The hard work that was done by the U.S. negotiators never really came to fruition, the benefits from that. So I've been saying, why don't we, you know, wouldn't it be more wouldn't it be better if we could just go back to the phase one? If the new administration could come in and say, hey, we negotiated this agreement, signed in January of 2020, let's live up to this. And if not, then we'll discuss what we need to do, but rather than having to start a new trade war. Now, maybe that's a way too simpleton approach, but I think it would be much more like a win-win opportunity rather than a lose-lose that I consider a trade war.
From the perspective of hunger, we're approaching a billion people who are food insecure. Many of those people are from countries where the economies are not so good.
Yes.
What opportunity does this afford in that same vein that you're talking about nutritional security and meeting this demand? Does this provide an opportunity for a value producer for like the U.S. or a least cost producer like Brazil, Argentina?
I think it creates an opportunity for demand growth. And demand growth is good for both the value producer and the lower price commodity producer. But here's let me tell you what we are doing in some of those markets. We've been running a campaign the last few years called the Right to Protein campaign. And when I say we've been trying to help organize this. We've been working with nutritionists, with healthcare providers, with governmental entities. We started this program in India. We've now taken it to several countries in South Asia. We're taking it to some countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Nigeria in particular, where we're talking about the right to protein and explaining how important protein is to the development of children. There is significant stunting problems in some of these countries. There's brain development problems. And it's just so sad. From a personal perspective, it's very sad when you think about that. But also from a kind of business perspective, it's an opportunity to help those people to understand that just providing calories is not necessarily enough. It needs to be the right calories, and that's where protein fits in. So we've seen many people speak very highly about this campaign. We've gotten real good response to it. So we hope that can continue to do the good work of helping to make sure that those children and other people have better nutrition while also growing demand for things like soy. We don't only talk about soy in this Right to Protein campaign, but soy is clearly a key way that protein can be added into diets, either directly as soy or through what we really like to see is through the production of meat. You know, people feeding chicken or growing fish or other animals.
So, Jim, if there is the effort to increase protein in the diets and use of protein among those who are food insecure, what other efforts are you employing to help sell that message and to tell that story?
One of the things we're doing, which is quite exciting to me, is a concept called the Soy Excellence Centers. And so in about 5 different hubs around the world, we're working with universities and other experts to train early stage workforce participants in how to more efficiently produce poultry, fish, how to produce feed, all of those kind of things, the kind of training you can imagine. But this is new for us. Always before we've targeted, and we will continue to target, the leaders of companies as we do our marketing. But this is a training effort, and we think that it will really pay long-term dividends by training people how to better do this. They'll understand how to differentiate the product. And they will also, because we're helping people who maybe haven't ever had the opportunity for training before, that's really going to build some loyalty to the U.S. So it's an exciting new program made possible with a USDA funding through the ATP, now the RAP, and also state checkoff funding is helping us with that.
We heard years ago of the opportunity with renewable diesel, with sustainable aviation fuel. And there seems to be an ocean of opportunity there if the U.S. oilseed producer and corn farmers and others are able to participate in this market. If this happens, how does the paradigm change?
So if it happens, what we've been forecasting, and it's not just us forecasting, but the forecasts we've seen and that we work with, are that soybean crush in the United States will go up pretty significantly. It'll increase by 35% over the next few years as more and more oil is required to feed this renewable diesel industry and maybe to some extent the sustainable aviation fuel industry. As that happens, there will be more soybean meal produced, and of this soybean meal that's produced, about two-thirds of that meal will go into the export channels. So the U.S. supply of soybean meal will go up 50 to 60%. So it'll be a huge jump in the availability of soybean meal coming out of the United States. At the same time, the forecasts that we're working with are that soybean production will continue to increase in the U.S. So over the next 10-year time period, the U.S. will still have about the same amount of soybeans to export, but will have almost 60% more soybean meal to export. So it really helps us in a couple of ways. Going back to diversification of markets. Soybean meal generally goes to different markets than soybeans go to, because people that need both the meal and the oil import soybeans. If they just need the meal, they have their own oil, like in Southeast Asia, they have palm oil, they import just the meal. So it gives us more meal to export out of the U.S. into a diversified set of markets. And I think the fact that we will still have soybeans to export allows us to continue to service those markets that like to buy the high-quality, sustainable soybeans coming out of the U.S. So while I think it's really good for U.S. soy farmers, what can come out of this renewable diesel biofuels movement, creating more demand for oil, I also think that it helps us in the export market. Some people have been concerned that, oh, it's a negative for, you know, the exports. I am on the contrary. I say, no, I think it can be really good. I think it can help us for all the reasons I just mentioned.
Is the global oilseed demand growing fast enough to consume what U.S. farmers are anticipated to produce and what the Brazilian and Argentine farmer are striving to produce?
This year, the year 24-25, we're going to see a record increase in supply of soybeans on the world market. If you think about what the U.S. just grew in terms of almost a record crop, and then Brazil, as we talked earlier, are going to have a 170 million ton or something, a record crop there. So we're looking at a almost 30 million ton or maybe even a little more increase in global supplies of soybeans. So that's about an 8% increase. That's the biggest we've ever seen in 1 year. Historically, demand grows 10, 15 million tons a year. So if you've got 30 and you're only growing at 10 or 15, no, you're not growing fast enough. But I would say, and I don't have, you know, we don't have exactly the hard numbers to back it up, but everybody I talk to and everywhere I go, I hear people talking about using more soybean meal in their rations, so increasing the inclusion. And I also hear about strong demand growth for poultry, for other types of meat, for eggs, for fish, and all of that uses more soybean meal. And let's face it, you know, they were faced, producers of all these things around the world were faced with very high commodity prices the last few years. It's been tough on them. Prices have come down. So they're enjoying very good margins as they're producing this meat, these meat products or other protein products. So I think that demand is growing at a very fast pace. Now, will that be enough to take off this 30-plus million tons of additional supply? I don't know. It doesn't have to be that much change. So I'm optimistic that this demand growth is happening maybe more than we expect, maybe faster than we expect.
So what would be the hope is that the global economy would improve and the middle class would continue to grow.
Absolutely, because that's what really drives it, Jeff, is more people in countries around the world wanting to improve their diets, wanting to have a little bit more meat, wanting to have an extra egg a week for their children or, you know, something that requires more protein. And now with prices being lower, we're building that demand base. So what I think is really the opportunity of the future is to have these lower prices, and nobody likes them, but the lower prices help us build demand. You know, the old adage, cure for low prices is low prices. So we see these low prices building this demand base. So then we get to the point where the market is consuming all we're producing today. And then as we've historically seen, you know, we can't have perfect weather everywhere every year. when there's some sort of a weather shock, weather problem, then that's when we see prices rally.
Jim Sutter, on behalf of soybean farmers and the soy industry, thank you for all the time that you and your staff and your farmer leaders spend not only working here in the U.S., but especially in overseas and informing and building relationships and creating opportunities. Thank you for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. Jim, you've been here before. You know it's Open Mic, and today you got the last word.
Jeff, thank you so much. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. And, you know, I only wish we would have had more time. There's so many more exciting things we could talk about. But I guess as my final words, I'd just like to say thank you. Thank you for communicating what it is that so many of us in agriculture do, because you really give kind of a spotlight out to the many listeners that you have. And I want to say thank you to all the people that I get to work with. It's really a pleasure for me to work with the U.S. soybean farmers, in, you know, whether it's the state associations, the national associations, in our USEC organization, the members that we have, and the team that USEC has. They work tirelessly around the world. We're so fortunate to be able to do the work we do. Thanks to USDA for the partnership. And it's just, you know, we've got a lot of work to do. And as I said as we started the conversation, now more than ever, the work that we do, I think, is important. And now more than ever, the collaboration and the partnership among these groups to do it together in as efficient way as we can is important. So thanks.
Our thanks to Jim Sutter, CEO of the U.S. Soybean Export Council, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the Soy Checkoff. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nelly.